Hello and welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor, and I am ding-dang ecstatic to be here with my homie, my bestie, co-host of the pod, the beautiful and lovely Sarah Century. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hi. That was...
I'm happy. I wasn't prepared with you.
I was like, here are compliments.
So many compliments. I wanted to talk about how whenever I talked to Monica, she would always be like, Sada. Like, she would just show up like around a corner and be like, Sada. And like, I, for some reason, every time someone says my name, I'm now like, it's been ingrained in my mind to where I'm like, Sada. Could you please pronounce my name correctly? Sada.
I'm sorry. Sada. Sada. You have some good news that's going on with your short story collection. Can we talk about that a little bit before we welcome our guests?
Of course. Yep. So I was nominated for the Wonderland Awards, which I had to dive into because I didn't know that much about it. It turns out that it's completely my jam. So it totally makes sense that I was nominated for the award. And it's alongside a lot of really great books, but basically the Wonderland Award is done by BizarroCon, and anybody who's ever attended a BizarroCon, I guess, can vote in it. And a couple of the people who are on the, who have been put out, their books have been put out by Weird Punk, such as Sam Richard, you know, they have already like won different Wonderland Awards in previous years. But there's also just a lot of really good, very weird stuff coming out of that kind of awards. It turned me on to two books. So I'm really excited about that. And congratulations to everybody else who was nominated, because anybody could win and I'd be happy. I like looked at the lineup and was just like, cool, everybody should win this. Like, all of these books are weird and good.
That's awesome. What's the title of your collection and where can people find it?
It is called A Small Light and Other Stories, and it is a short story anthology about people being creeps, I guess, by me.
That is actually kind of a good description.
By me, professional creep. But it's basically just like, you know, it, to me, if I want to describe it as the kind of horror where it's like they're standing right behind me, aren't they? Like, or something like that. Like, that's basically the kind of horror that I do. And sad. Like, they're sad. Sad people working out their problems. It turns into monsters, et cetera, et cetera. So,
and very, very, very queer. Very, very
yep,
queer.
Oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, yeah, that part kind of goes without saying, I guess. But yeah, no, for sure. Very queer. Lots of gays. And, you know, just it's about, you know, interpersonal relationships and how hard they are, I guess, but in a scary way.
And if you want to hear Sarah talk about it more, you can check out episode 146 of Bitches on Comics, which you're listening to. And the lovely Danny Lore joins us as a guest host. Mm-hmm. And me and Danny just grill Sarah. Yeah. We just ask so many questions.
Tough stuff with you and Danny. Yeah, it was tough stuff. I was under the light on that one, but...
Yeah, we were swinging the light in your eyes, you know, just really trying to get that investigative journalism feel.
Yeah, that was a really fun interview, honestly. I really liked talking to both of you in general. So it was like, oh, and now we're talking about things that I think are good. Like, this is fun. And, you know, why did I write this story? Well, let's get into it because, you know, this is the first I've considered. But... yeah, it's basically that. You can get it anywhere. I have an Amazon author page. I'm always popping up in anthologies and stuff. So I have some coming up, but I can't even discuss it because, you know, publishing and stuff.
But, publishing!
You know, where they're like, you write something and then like 3 years later, somebody's like, cool, you can announce it now. And you're like, oh yeah, I do still like that thing that I wrote 3 years ago. And you know, I mean, I was going to try to like seg into like, and our guest today might know what that's like, but I don't want to put too much on them to try to be like, oh, publishing is actually really hard. Let's not start on that note. But, so
it sure is.
It's yeah. I think that's a running theme actually for many, many, many creators that we've talked to on this podcast.
There are books that I wrote in 2018 that art is now being wrapped up in 2023.
Oof. Yeah. Ugh. just...
It's going to be a great one, though. Once I can talk about it, it's going to be fucking awesome. It looks so good. It is very much worth the wait.
Yeah, it always is, right? That's kind of also like the flip side of it is it always is actually worth the wait. This is perhaps one of the oddest, like I said, the segue is maybe a little rocky, but we have a guest today and you already heard their voice actually. So
I jumped the gun. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, you know, the gun is being jumped. I mean, it's how it is today, but this is Ben Kahn, who we've had on the podcast multiple times. I believe you are now one of our most recurring guests. So thanks again for coming back, because it's always a delight to talk to you. I remember the one that I remember the most is us all just being like, Legends of Tomorrow, the CW, and talking about it. And that was just half of the, it was like the back half of the interview was just being like, CW, here's all the shows we like and now miss, right? But
yep.
Welcome. It is so nice to hear from you, to hear your voice. I was going to say see you, but that is not in fact what I'm doing. I am not seeing you.
It is absolutely wonderful to be back. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, only getting one episode of Donald Faison as Booster Gold, it does haunt my nightmares to this day.
I'm not talking about it. I'm not open to discussing it. So please move on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, we all miss
But Legends. At least now we have the, I don't know what CW is doing these days, the Christian lawyer shared universe sitcom, I guess. Is that what they got going on?
Yeah, because they lost my beloved Riverdale. So, I mean, now that everybody is like 30, right? Like they had to stop playing teenagers. I love that show so much. But
I've seen the first two seasons. I'm watching it with a friend. And I mean, I'm only two seasons in and I'm like, how deeper into the madness can I get?
Yes.
Knowing that I have yet to even begin to scratch the surface of the madness.
All the best things are still coming, Ben. All the best things are still coming.
I think things are crazy at Betty's serial killer genes. I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah. The serial killer genes are hilarious.
Oh my God. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, Betty, maybe you have serial killer genes. You might want to check on that. So funny.
And this is when she's camming, right? In season two, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. The weird camming brother. The maybe brother. Oh, boy, that storyline went to places. I know I have a book coming out, but can we just talk about Riverdale for an hour?
Yeah, we can. Because it's relevant, because ultimately Riverdale is relevant to everything if you just keep talking long enough, and then it'll be like, wait a second, that episode actually relates to my book.
I'm glad like Cole Sprouse is free, because every interview is like that he gives is just being like, what planet are you on, Cole Sprouse? Do you need help, Cole Sprouse? Blink twice.
I mean, he's been a celebrity for so long. I don't even, like, is he even there? Is he just, like, checked out, you think? You think he's just in the back of his head doing something else?
Pretty much his entire conscious memories of life have been either Sweet Life of Zack and Cody or Riverdale.
Right?
Like, what does that do to a mind?
What does it do to a mind?
Everybody being like, the whole, like, what was it? The first, like, oh my God, not even. The first, like, three or four seasons, they're like, hey, can I get some jingle jangle? And like everybody is so dead serious.
Oh my God.
Every
so
single
funny.
One of those actors deserves every award because their like stony faced delivery of these absolutely ludicrous lines, I think, is just absolutely stunning.
I'm a big fan of how many episodes in season two are just, we're going to introduce a super shocking plotline that goes nowhere.
They go nowhere.
So they could just put scenes of it in like the trailers and commercials.
Absolutely.
Like Archie joins like a prison fighting ring, like an underground prison.
I can't
prison.
Even, Sarah. What the fuck?
But then it's just like, he just leaves.
Archie joins like a militia. Archie creates his own vigilante militia
group. Yeah.
on multiple occasions.
Everybody's super into it, and they're like, "Good job, Archie." And I'm just like, "That's not what happens in real life. Like, everybody's scared of you if you start a militia."
How many plots are dissolved by Archie going, and here's my shirtless boy gang?
Yeah, let me whip off this shirt real quick, and then I'm going to go wrestle with the dudes or whatever. And you're just like, you know what? This is good-ass TV.
I mean, just episode after episode of Veronica third-wheeling between the insane sexual chemistry between Archie and her dad.
Yes. Oh, my God. It's very tense.
Mind-blowingly, someone was like, yeah, you know what we need? Real sexy Hiram Lodge.
Yeah, like the hottest take on Hiram Lodge that you could dig up. And it's just like, oh, okay. Like soap opera star for 30 years guy. Like bring him in here to be sexy Hiram Lodge. It's like, okay.
It was a choice to be like, okay, we need the hottest 28-year-olds on the planet to play teens, and then we need the hottest 40-year-olds on the planet to play their parents, and that will be a show. And by golly, they were correct.
It's my favorite. I love it so much.
I mean, how many, I'm sure, Skeet Ulrich, Luke Perry, like, fanfics there are? Like, that's just, like,
those two,
middle-aged man yowie.
Oh, my God. Like, the chemistry, and they're both just, like, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. And it's just like, what's up, old
kiss,
friend?
Kiss,
and they're just like, kiss. Remember whenever we, you know, it's like scene upon scene is just that. And you're just like, I'm just like popcorn. I'm watching. I'm never going to look away. I love this show so much. Everybody. Oh, I love everybody. And I've been doing so many interviews where Archie just comes up like all over the place. Like this is now kind of like the Archie podcast a little bit. We like did the Jamie Rotonde interview like early this year, and she's the editor of Archie. And I was just like, you deserve an award. Like, you should be like
this. I mean, I want to give Riverdale all of the roses, if only for giving us the absolute sapphic icon that is Cheryl Blossom.
And now Cheryl, we have broached Blossom, the reason Sarah loves the show.
Cheryl Blossom and Tony Topaz. I love them so much.
It's very strangely gender affirming when like the only little like image Netflix gives me for Riverdale is just various Tony and Cheryl images.
Yeah. It's like with they never understood. It's like, first of all, people didn't understand Cheryl because she wasn't gay, basically. Like, I feel like forever that was a great character that was just waiting to be gay. And people didn't understand lesbians because lesbians are never mean unless it's like in media, they're never mean unless it's like 70s exploitation films or something like that level of mean.
Or unless it's the L word and a bisexual character exists.
Yes, exactly. Listen. And they're like, descend upon the bisexuals.
They're just hyenas.
Yeah. And then but that's it. I was just like, Cheryl is the best of both worlds. Like, this is a character that clearly should have just always been gay, first of all. And then it's like, she's a dick. It's really awesome.
She's got the camp and menace of like a 90s Disney villain, but actually gets to be canonically gay.
She like later, I don't want to spoil this, but like later she just kind of she defects from the town of Riverdale. Like she like,
amazing. And then I need no other context.
And then she just brings in a bunch of like kids basically to like teach young women how to do archery. Basically she becomes Sappho pretty much. Where she's done. Like got her own cult.
If you tell me that there is a story where like fucking Cheryl becomes an Amazon queen to stop Cop City in Riverdale, I'm like, I have absolutely no reason to disbelieve you.
She tells Archie to go fuck himself basically because he's just like law and order, and she's just like chaos. And you're just like, yes, this is the best TV.
Like, I know it's supposed to be a show, like, you know, Archie and Veronica, but Archie truly only simps for one thing in Riverdale, and that's authority.
For sure. He is.
God, he loves authority.
He's like obsessed.
You really think
with
about
it
from his first storyline. You are absolutely correct. You know what? I'm going to write that down in my journal.
To his last, like, all the way through.
That's, you know what? So, okay, so here's my real question, Sarah, is did you and Jamie get a chance off the air to discuss when you're writing your Cheryl Blossom comic?
No, I hope that I do get to write a Cheryl Blossom comic because
we all deserve it.
Yes, we need, the world needs it.
I hope that this occurs. I was like not trying to like pitch a million.
I know, I was mostly teasing, but yes.
But I was also just like, just so you know, I love Cheryl more than anybody loves a character. Like
we need like the be gay, do crime, Cheryl Blossom oversized one shot.
Everything that she says that goes nowhere on Riverdale is its own series, right?
Like, which is like by season one, they're already being like, yup, grandma's magic.
Jesus, this fucking show.
Cheryl's got a magic grandma. Just, what about it?
She's a time travel lesbian in the sixth season. Like, she literally like goes back in history and plays her descendants. Or, no, sorry, her ancestors. So it's like in the 50s, apparently she had an ancestor that was like seducing all of the wives. And then all of the pro-authority Archies of the world were like, stop seducing all of our wives. And she was like, I can't. And so they put her in jail.
It's the real energy of when Legends of Tomorrow said, fuck it, and decided to just make Sarah Lance the main character.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, there's a few failings of Riverdale. One of them is that there's just not enough friendship between Veronica and Betty. Like, you just don't see them interacting enough. And then with Cheryl, it's like they started so off the rails that they like could never totally, like there's seasons where they're like, I don't know what to do with her. Should we do like a Dark Phoenix riff, I guess?
In a show that started off the rails, Cheryl was in a whole other theme park.
Yeah, for sure. And so at a certain point, I think they were just like, what else should we do? But then that gives us episodes like Time Travel Lesbian, where she's
10 out of 10,
back.
No notes.
She gets possessed by a gay ancestor. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff. You know what? God bless. I'm very excited for you to get through Riverdale.
I'm very excited to see how much more of Final Fantasy VIII that like found its way into Riverdale. I'm sorry. You get possessed by time traveling lesbian witches. That's some Final Fantasy VIII shit right there.
Yeah, it's very much just like a like draw three words out of a hat kind of situation with Cheryl at a certain point where they're like, okay, Dark Phoenix, okay.
So what you're saying is that Riverdale has done the best version of the Dark Phoenix saga.
I'm not going to say that they didn't, actually. I was like, this is like good Dark Phoenix, actually. It's good, honestly. I mean, they do the best multiverse because their version of the multiverse, Veronica, is just like tries to like use the two Reggies to have a threesome, basically. Like there's two Reggies that keep fighting with each other. And like Veronica is just like sitting there one day and she's like in front of the fire drinking a cocktail and the two Reggies are like arguing on the couch. And she's like, you know, we could have a pretty sweet deal going on here. And like then,
and this is why Crisis on Infinite Earths only gets a 9 out of 10.
Exactly. This is the 10 star. And then also it's why Veronica is like the icon of the show forever. But she's basically just like, hey, and then like they're like, okay, cool. Yeah, absolutely. And they like whip their shirts off and then they're like, I'm more handsome than you. And they just start like fighting each other. And she's like, neither of you are man enough for Veronica Lodge. Like runs out.
I do love that we got to see in action the fight or fuck response when you meet your duplicate.
And with Reggie, it's just fighting.
Yeah.
Yep. I love it. But yes. Oh my God. Best multiverse. Best everything. Love it. Best Twilight Zone pastiche. Best Dark Phoenix. Best everything.
Riverdale was just 7 seasons of let's just do it and be legends.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think at a certain point, they're just packing as many wild plot lines into a single episode that they can. They're like, let's just, he fights a bear, maybe. Do you think? Yeah, let's have him fight a bear.
You know what? I think he should fight a bear. Done.
No other show leaves me in wild bewilderment as something happens and I suddenly remember, oh, right, this was a new plot line that got introduced 20 minutes ago that has already left my brain.
And it will leave again. It will not get followed up on. They will like leave it totally open-ended. It's just like, Jughead's mom, maybe evil? Don't know. Anyway, she's gone. She'll be back in 3 seasons. Totally different character at that point.
Like, I feel like a baby just having keys shaken in front of them, where it's just like, wait, okay, I think I have a handle on the plot. Wait, why is Molly Ringwald back now?
Yep.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. Well,
what a show.
Thank you.
What a show. for this. Now that we're 20 minutes in.
Yeah, we're primed and ready to go to talk about things. But I'm really glad that we got this off of our like minds, because I was like, every morning I wake up and I'm like, who can I convince to talk about Riverdale with me?
It is the modern Plato at wherever Plato did Greek philosophizing at.
We're like, fuck Greek philosophy. We have Riverdale.
Yeah. I mean,
honestly, look at the Odyssey, look at Riverdale, look me in the eye and tell me which is the crazier storylines.
And which is a better foundation for philosophy, right? Like, let's actually think about it. Probably the one where Veronica Lodge runs a speakeasy at 16. I think that's probably a better option.
And then a casino, and you're just like, what? She just goes into a business with Reggie as a casino owner in season 6.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that before or after Reggie challenges Archie for duel for leadership over their like racist violence gang?
Yeah. They have a racist violence gang, and then like the gangs are wild. There's just like 7 gangs in like this like incredibly small town in the Midwest or whatever.
I still just can't get over. There's a whole episode where it's just Archie refuses to crack to the FBI. And then at the end, we're like, yes, that was the right call, Archie. You did good not snitching.
Wait, I forgot that he became a capo. I forgot that he became Veronica's dad's fucking lieutenant.
And then at the end of the season, he gets arrested. He's like, for what? I've been framed. It's like, you joined the mob, Archie. What are you going to jail for? All the crime you did this season.
What, me?
You're an accessory to the murder of Papa Poutine.
Papa Poutine, I forgot.
The Canadian gangster Papa Poutine.
How did this show air? How did they get away with Papa Poutine? Jingle jangle. I mean, these things are so hilarious.
This Someone show actively could... trying to have group sex with alternate reality versions of her boyfriend. Like, I mean, there's so many things where you're just like, bravo. Like, there's total silence at the end of an episode, and then you slowly like stand and start to like clap, and then everybody starts to clap, and you're like, yeah, yeah.
I think what happened to CW is that like showrunners started to realize they were in this kind of like, president's just to like lifting his head up from a pile of cocaine once a year going, fuck it, renew everything. And I think showrunners are like really taking advantage of that.
Yeah. I talked to Tim Hanley about this because he wrote a book about Betty and Veronica. And of course, Riverdale came up, right? But it was basically just like, what are they going to do going forward? But also, like, what do you think? How do you think that this even happened, basically? Like, how did these wholesome icons of, you know,
like, so how? Followed by why? Yeah. Followed by how do I get involved?
I can tell you exactly how. Because if you take your brain back to the early 2000s and remember vaguely hearing about a story of some guy who put on an unauthorized Archie, like, play where everyone was like gay and depressed and adult, and Archie was sent him a cease and desist to stop. Fast forward a few decades, and they went back to that guy and was like, hey, want to make a CW show?
It was almost Twin Peaks Archie, but then it was like, no, let's get weirder than Twin Peaks. And you're like, how did it get like weirder than Twin Peaks?
It should have been a 5-minute SNL skit.
Right.
And wound up 7 seasons.
So what I'm hearing is that we should probably get together and do a Riverdale podcast. And maybe we could get each of the actors in for like an episode to like talk about that episode and be like, so tell me, when they handed you this script, famous actor, how did you wrap your head around being a shirtless capo in a football game in the middle of a prison? What, did you study prisons? Like, how did you get there?
Just walks out of prison. I mean, it's just like, he's just like, I was just here for the underground fighting ring. Now I'm a free man.
Isn't there like a whole point like, where they're like, Archie, you should leave prison. And he's like, I'm not going to leave prison.
As an actor, when you walk on set and there's just 30 buff shirtless men wearing like red ski masks.
Yeah.
What do you do as an actor to put yourself in the scene?
Oh, man.
Walk me through your process in this moment.
Yeah. I whip that shirt off and then I join them.
And I'm ready. I become the character. I am Archie.
Where I actually did method acting. I started my own gang. I really can't talk much about January 6th.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no. What do teenagers get out of this? Because I was like, I know what I, as like a 40-year-old lesbian, get out of Riverdale. But then I was like, I wonder what kids get out of it. And I like, it's like they literally just ship like Bughead and stuff. And you're just like, oh. Well, that's a fun direction to take things. Like, that's very normie because I was like, oh, cool. Like, you all, like, ship the actors and you, like, want different actors to hang out. And to me, it's like you watch Riverdale, like, literally just to watch everybody's relationships explode for yes. 7 seasons, essentially.
Oh, yeah. Just this constant state of everybody's making everything a secret and you constantly have to spend like the whole episode trying to keep up with who knows which secret.
Gen Z, write in because we need to know what it is you love about
Maybe that's this. The podcast is we just talk to Gen Z about why they like Riverdale and then tell them why we like it and then they walk out mid-interview.
We did an episode of Progressively Horrified where we brought a Gen Z kid out to talk about Marble Hornets, this YouTube Slender Man series. And that was a good call of just having someone be like, I knew Slender Man, the sex icon. So it was interesting to see the character back in his horror roots.
You're like, I'm sorry, huh? Walk me through the sex icon part. I'm not mad. I just want to understand.
I just want to know. For personal I mean, reasons.
There's no face and tentacles. What's there to explain?
Well, I'm physically dead. God. Let's call it an episode. That'll do it, folks. Enjoy our Riverdale rant. We did it. Wait a minute. Hello, listeners. I know you love the pod. I know you're about it. You're like, wow, Bitches on Comics. What a bunch of awesome bitches who tend to talk about comics. But did you know there's a way you can support us? You can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/queerspec, and you'll get access to all of our BOC-related bonus material. That's interviews, special conversations, deep dives on the things we're enjoying at the moment, and access to our bonus material for all of our other projects, including Decoded Horror Channel, which if you're not listening, you need to tune into now, Decoded Horror Channel. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. But as part of Decoded Horror Channel, we're going to have special drink recipes available for you and the whole shebang. It's going to be a good time, and I hope you'll join us at patreon.com/queerspec.
And Legends of Tomorrow, and this time we decided just to
like let's start out of the gate.
Started you out know what?
I need to make a new book so we can spend a half an hour talking about All American.
Yep.
Oh God, y'all are too funny. I can't even. I'm like, how do I segue us to talk about your book? I'm usually the king of segues, but I'm like, fuck, man.
Right. We could say, you know, you've written actually a lot of books and you could tell us about some of them. Because I don't even think we made it to the part. You were like, I'm a writer.
Yes. Oh my God, really?
Hi, I'm Ben Kahn. I'm a professional Riverdale watcher. Yes, I am a writer. Up until pretty much now, I have done comics. You might have seen some of my work. Heavenly Blues, Renegade Rule, the comic tie-in to Immortals Phoenix Rising. But I am now, as of a few weeks ago, a novelist. My first book, L. Campbell Wins Their Weekend, a story, a zany, fun-filled story about a non-binary seventh grader trekking across town to meet their celebrity hero and try to figure out more about themselves. Hit bookstores October 17th, and it is amazing to see it out and about.
Mm. Well, and it was so cool. You were able to get us early copies. Thank you so much. It was so neat to read it. It was neat to see you working in the prose format. So maybe that's a cool place to start since, you know, I'll start with this. Listeners, if you haven't caught our other episodes with Ben, you are missing out. Go check them out. They are a delightful time. Episode 28 is called Cat Picks and the Creative Process, which our chat before recording today was like, yeah, that did remind me of that. And we talk a lot about the comic Griffin, The Galaxy's Most Wanted, that amazing comic. And then in episode 92, Unabashedly Queer Action Comedy with Rachel Silverstein, as well as Ben, we talk about Renegade Rule, the super fun e-gamer comic that I think Sarah and I were both just huge fans of. So, you know, we've talked about your comics. We will again today if we have time. We'll see if we get there. We put in some Riverdale time. But, you know, we had to.
Well, Griffin, if you listen to the Griffin episode, if you're a fan of Griffin, back then it was a digital series. It has actually gotten a print release. It was released as a 3-issue miniseries this spring from Massive Publishing. And you can purchase all 3 double-sized issues on the Massive Publishing website. And it was amazing, again, to bring the story of Lila Criven and all their fascist stabbing to comic book stores.
I would love to hear about it since we're here. Like, what was the process of seeing it in print like? How did it feel to hold it in your hands and like in another medium besides digital, which we can hold in our hands in a different way? But, you know, like, what was that like?
I mean, once you're holding it and you put it on your bookshelf, then it's like, it's real. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, I was so glad for, you know, to get Griffin out in digital and thankful everyone who read it digitally and supported the book, having it out in stores, getting to bring in a whole bunch of awesome artists like Dave Stoll, Bailey Underwood, Sam Beck to come in and do variant covers was really cool. And actually getting, you know, there's nothing like actually just getting to flip through it and, you know, it was a couple years from digital to print. So, you know, it was definitely just a real feeling of like, yeah, this, the wait really paid off that we really got to, you know, we waited, we did it right. We got a like Massive Publishing. He did it so well, designed such a good presentation for it. And yeah, it was just really nice being able to bring this story, you know, give it a kind of a new lease on life and introduce it to a whole new audience.
It's so exciting because I think Griffin is such a fun comic, you know, like you said, you sort of casually said fascist stabbing. But, you know, it does feel like a really integral part of it for me of
this,
non-binariness as anti-fascist. And I really was touched by that.
Yeah, Griffin is queer wrath personified in a world where a human empire has given in to all of humanity's worst impulses.
So our timeline. Thank you. Perfect.
Yes.
Just joking. I hope. I hope that was a joke.
Look, there's a reason why when I'm at the conventions, I call this book my 2016 trauma response comic.
Right. Yeah.
That feels real.
I mean, there was a lot of just, you know, feeling very disillusioned about humanity and needing to, you know, kind of create a world where all this power, where, you know, I could channel all this, you know, just this powerlessness into somebody that, you know, would know, but knew well enough to punch Nazis first, ask questions never.
Yeah. That was the funnest part of that comic. I'm like recollecting fondly.
They got shot out of space just to punch a Nazi in the face from orbit. Which is still one of my favorite sequences I've ever written. Bruno Hidalgo did the orbital space punch so well. Like, that's one of just my absolute favorite just pages of comics that we did together.
Yeah, I got to get the print version. I don't have the print version yet, but I'm very thrilled to actually see it. Plus those variants, as you brought the variants up, and they're just like stunning.
Oh, yeah. The Rufus Dayglow did another great one. And yeah, there's going to be a trade next year. So hopefully we'll have more info about the Griffin Galaxy's Most Wanted trade real soon. But yeah, my novel, L. Campbell Wins Their Weekend, not as much punching, but equally, if not more, non-binary.
Well, you know, yes. we're gonna dive in deep here, but I had warned you before we recorded, I wanted to talk a little bit, and this actually would be a good segue, about the process of moving from writing comics to prose. And I think that's also a good way to talk about this book specifically, because what made you want to move into a new genre and tell this specific story? So maybe tell us a little bit about like what the process was like, but then also what the reasoning behind it was.
Yeah, so the process was, you know, I was very fortunate to get a chance to kind of pitch the Scholastic and write some test chapters. And a big part of why, you know, I kind of pursued this process was really just the sense of it just seemed, you know, the opportunity kind of gave my way to try my best, kind of throw my hat in the ring, and the chance to just really challenge myself to such a degree was too enticing not to, you know, really give my all to. Like, I hadn't really planned on writing prose, but once, you know, I kind of had the opportunity to try it, I wanted to just give it my all and just really, and prove to myself if it was something I could do and try my best. And again, telling the story, you know, moving away from some of the more genre trappings of my previous work to dive into just slice of life and get to just tell a purely story about non-binary identity and growing up. Again, it was something new and something challenging, and the thrill of the new and the challenging will always be, you know, something I want to pursue for the rest of my career. I want to always just keep pushing myself in new genres, new mediums, new boundaries, just, you know, never get too comfortable as a writer, always keep challenging myself. And, you know, and also just the sheer fact of, you know, getting to kind of write about that non-binary identity from a place that's real near and dear to my heart. You know, a lot of it is just imagining trying to figure out Elle's character. A lot of it was just trying to imagine, you know, what if I'd figured my gender shit out at 12 instead of 28?
Oof. Sorry, I just had to, that was like a weird road for me mentally to go down and to be like, yeah, what if we all did? Like,
I was muted, Sarah, but you went oof, and I off mic went oof, and so we did it at the exact same time.
It's like, because, yeah, I mean, there is so little, right? Like, there's so, even now, I think that there's, like, so little of that, I guess, in books. So, yeah, I went into like, an alternate timeline for a hot second where I was like, oh, everything's different. We all get to experience this on our own or whatever without, like, you know, outside forces and all of this. But yeah, I think that this is the kind of book where it's like, yeah, if you had read this like when you were like 12, right? Like, it could have been a game changer.
And so much, you know, at the start of the book, so much of what has helped Elle figure themselves out and already come out to their friends and family and socially transition is they saw a non-binary main hero in their favorite TV show.
Right.
There's a kind of a Doctor Who analog called Phantom Thief that I had a lot of fun just making up various plots of episodes for.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, I'm just upset Phantom Thief doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like, I fucking want to watch that, man. Like, it sounds lit.
I got to now pitch like the in-universe Phantom Thief novel. This is my backdoor pilot.
Yes. In-universe stuff is always my very favorite, so I just love that. But I read an interview where you said that you weren't too deeply enmeshed in Doctor Who. I wanted to say that, I watch a ton of Doctor Who, and, like, it's one of those shows where it's awesome. There's a lot of good, like, progressive ideas behind it. It's, like, very openly anti-war back in, like, the 70s when that was not necessarily the vibe, I guess, like, globally. So I think that it's like, it's a great series, but then I was thinking too, that something that's as fun as it is about this, you know, this actual kind of like offshoot or like a, what would you call it? Like a it's based on it, kind of, right? Like, but yeah, it goes kind in of a different direction.
An analog or...
Yes.
Not a pastiche, you. But yeah, like an analog, yeah.
Yeah, so I was thinking about that because it's like, there is a lot of progressive politics to Doctor Who, but a lot of people, of course, have called out the less progressive parts of it. And I think, too, that there's just something where it's set up so well to be non-binary, right? Because you have a doctor that can be reincarnated in really any form, right? And so the fact that they're just now like, oh, I guess the doctor could be a woman or like, you know, I guess the doctor doesn't always have to be white is like just kind of, and how much they've had to fight like with kind of, you know, like the networks and everything to get it to even that place. I was just thinking like, this is kind of like what Doctor Who, as much as I already love Doctor Who, I was like, this is kind of like the natural progression of Doctor Who, I guess, in a weird way.
I was seeing articles just being like, have there been too many Scots playing Doctor Who? As do we need to bring dialect back? Has it gotten too progressive with all, like, what's next, a Welsh Doctor Who?
And that's it. Like, you see people, it's an interesting one because, it, you know, a lot of the fandoms that I know that we're all, you know, at least interested in, right? Like, you know, X-Men, you know, any of these where it's like, it's even Star Wars, I guess, there is a implicit progressive attitude to a lot of the works, but then you'll see the fandom in some ways or like the networks who don't necessarily understand like the root of the franchise be like, absolutely not, you know, kind of, or there will be a lot of pushback when people are trying to like kind of push the franchise forward.
The sheer absurdity of the statement, like, when did Star Trek get woke?
Right. It's like, come on now. Like,
it's literally about fighting a fascist regime. I'm so sorry. What the fuck are you talking about?
Why are they putting politics in my Star Wars, the rebels are the Viet Cong? Yeah. George Lucas would never allow this.
Yeah. And I mean, same with like X-Men, you know, all of these where you're just like, these are all franchises. I can understand why people will look at a character like Batman and be like, oh, Batman's a fascist or like whatever, which is not a stance that I agree with because I don't believe that he's written that way anymore, you know? But there have been right-wing writers on Batman and he was a hell of a cop, you know, like,
oh, yeah,
at that time. So it's an interesting one.
Well, you go back to 1966. If it turned out that the commissioner of police had a private line to a vigilante to commit extrajudicial assaults? That's a scandal!
On the campiest villains that are, like, so, like truly over-the-top queer, you know? Like, all of those villains.
And he wants all of them so bad, yeah, you know? And he's just like, but I have to beat you up!
Yeah.
God, nothing will ever be gayer in Batman than Cesar Romero refusing to shave his mustache.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
I want to talk about a couple of the things that you bring into Elle because I was thinking about, obviously, like 80s comedies and stuff like that. So we'll talk about that. But I wanted to talk about its kind of genre roots, right? Because it, to me, yeah, looking at this show, it is such like the natural progression of Doctor Who. But, you know, Doctor Who is owned, you know, all of these franchises are owned by people that don't necessarily have progressive politics, right? So it's like there is kind of this ceiling on the growth that they're allowed to do at this point. Like, not necessarily that they can't do interesting, fun, cool, progressive things, but that there's kind of like the nature of, you know, them trying to please everybody with a franchise like the X-Men really holds it back as a story, right?
Yeah, you know, it's the inherent limitation of critiquing capitalism from within a capitalist system.
Yeah.
You know, capitalism is really good at absorbing, co-opting, and defanging its critics.
Yes, I think that that's part of what I'm trying to get to, right? Is like that there is this kind of like assimilate and destroy kind of with criticism. I mean, we've seen most I think, great criticism sites.
The Borg got fucking nothing on capitalism.
True. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess I don't know. There's like kind of something to that where I was just like, yeah, Doctor Who is great. Like, I love Doctor Who. You know, I have my criticisms, as most people do, right? But I was thinking, too, that, like, this is what I want to see this show. So if you end up doing an in-universe version of it, that's, like, that will be, like, the Doctor Who for me.
Oh, yeah. And those limitations are real. I mean, you saw it every time, again, to go back to Star Trek, as explicitly progressive as it always was. I mean, it's history on queer rights and how much it's either tried to paper over that or embrace it. I mean, to this day, we still, you know, we're looking at shows and wondering, like, oh, are they getting notes and being told to tone it down and being forced to? Like, it's, again, it's, like you said, the limit of, like, even when creators are bringing in progressive policies, I mean, which is so much more often than you think if you, like, from just what's on the screen. I mean, for every bit of queer representation or truly progressive messaging that makes it onto the screen, there is probably 10 characters or story concepts that a writer or somebody fought for but couldn't make happen.
Yeah.
Anthony Oliveira was on the podcast and said something that completely changed the way I think about queer representation on TV. He said, so often what people call queer baiting, and he was talking about comics and TV and film. So often what we identify as queer baiting is actually a queer person behind the scenes desperately trying to get a story across. And this is how much it got watered down. It started as something 100%. Else, and it has been watered down to this point. Now, does it make me want to give everybody a pass on queer baiting? Absolutely not. But it makes me have a more nuanced lens, which Sarah and I talk about a lot, because I think sometimes there's a knee-jerk sort of protectionist reaction in queer communities where people say, like, well, that person's not queer, so, like, this story is queer baiting. And it's like, A, have you don't know that. You don't know that. Like, how many people have we seen recently get badgered out of the closet by toxic fandom, right? Like, that's not the move, friends. We're actually not trying to oppress each other.
Yeah. One thing that, you know, is definitely just a little concerning in various fandom spaces, and it's an element of, you know, what's known behind the scenes versus, you know, what's presented publicly. There's definitely a mismatch, but it really sucks seeing good creators trying their best, like, truly, like, raked over the coals for storytelling decisions that may have their names on it, but they did not have any power over.
And that's the challenge with franchises, right? Like, what both of you are saying, with, like, so much established lore and, frankly, so much money at risk, there's only so much breathing room for queer and trans and intersex representation, characters, storylines, creators behind the scenes. Like, and that is terrible. But that's also why we need books like L. Campbell Saves Their Weekend. Or, I'm sorry, I got the title wrong. It's L. Campbell Wins Their Weekend. Thank you. You know, that's exactly it. Like, what you were saying, Sarah, is, like, that's why we need this. And that's why we need the Phantom Thief in it, because it is this, the Phantom Thief has already been non-binary in that world. You know what I mean? It's not something we're aspiring for. It exists. And you really take the time to show us, you know, as much as representation is not an answer, right? It is the beginning of a conversation at most. It is a beginning of a conversation that helps a lot of people who may not have seen themselves otherwise.
Yeah, it's not the whole journey, but I think representation can definitely be a part of it. And it can definitely be the spark just to let you know what's possible.
Absolutely.
Especially if you're in a world that hasn't given you the imagery or the terminology or the words that truly capture who you are. I mean, there's a particular chapter of the book where Elle discovers art exhibit. So I think I called it Baba's Eccentric Journey, which hopefully people will realize exactly which particular long-running manga I'm actually referring to that was incredibly important on kicking off my own gender journey. Yeah, when people say JoJo's Bizarre Adventure made them gay, they're not always joking.
You're like, those people are me. And that's actually what I wanted to talk about too a little bit here is you dedicated the book to Now I'm opening it, of course, to everyone who found themselves in stories. And you know, you and I have talked about this before. I don't know if it was just on the internet or if it was one of our episodes or what, but, you know, both being non-binary, we've really, I think probably more than a lot of people, railed about representation in sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, because so often it's this triptych of who you named, I wrote it down, androids, aliens, and ghosts. That's who gets to be non-binary. But the problem is that human beings are non-binary. And I'm going to quote you to yourself again, because that's the kind of mood I'm in. This is what the book says about it. Nuri, who is the non-binary phantom thief, Nuri had showed Elle that being non-binary wasn't just real. It was deeply and wonderfully human. And so when we talk about JoJo's, which I obviously want to hear more about, is that the story that helped you break that door open? Is that how you discovered that?
It very much was, in that JoJo's really did, specifically some of the stuff in the second part, Battle Tendency, Joseph Joestar represent. There was this, it was kind of some of the first time really encountering this real blend of masculine and feminine that really spoke to me, and really kind of, I was definitely at a point where I'm like, where I was really struggling to figure out the various aspects of masculinity and femininity that fit me, because I definitely did feel this uncomfortable blend, and trying to make sense of it was this very confusing, overwhelming time. And JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, some of, you know, these character designs, you know, these some of these incredibly, you know, powerful, muscular figures, but in these incredibly feminine or fashionable outfits and very striking poses. It was one of the first times I really saw this blend of masculinity and femininity in a way that spoke to what was resonating inside me.
Well, in that vein, you know, human characters who are non-binary are still incredibly rare. It is, since I have started, you know, writing professionally about sci-fi, fantasy, and horror, there hasn't been a huge uptick. You know, a part of me, you know, there was a bright-eyed day in 2015 when I started to think, you know, like maybe we will get the, you know, the things I care about, the non-binary swamp thing, the, you know, the genderqueer John Constantine, the, you know, all the layers of I don't know why I'm only thinking DC, but that's what's coming to me. You know, like those pieces felt so within reach.
Well, Constantine feels like he should be railing against any form of authority or hierarchy, including gender.
And good night. You know what? Fuck it. That's the podcast. We're done. How many times can I make that joke before people get mad at me? We'll find out. But you know, I really do feel like that is exactly how I feel. It's like you present us these characters who, by every possible recognition of what they believe, see, experience, how could they not be, if not non-binary, genderqueer, what have you, gender weird, gender questioning, you know, they're, that just feels obvious. And I think this is going to connect, but you'll tell me if it does. And I was reading L. Campbell Wins Their Weekend, and I was like, how funny that Ben chose not to make this like a real genre book. Like, genre is really important. Comics, sci-fi, fantasy, they're all important to the characters, but it's a book that, it's a story that belongs in some version of our reality, right? There is not, at least as far as I've seen.
Yeah, no, it's definitely that kind of, you know, John Hughesian, almost overly perfect suburb where,
yes,
things where there's lots of entertaining things and that aren't completely hostile to the existence of children.
Yes.
Being like hanging out.
Yes, yes, yes. And I remember when I started, I was like, well, why wouldn't Ben's so good at sci-fi fantasy? Like, why wouldn't they write this? And then I got to that part in the book that I read back to you about the importance of seeing human beings who are non-binary. And I was like, oh, shit, is that why? And you don't actually have to answer that specific question, but I would love to hear a little bit about, you know, what it is that made you want to do a story that's set in our world, the John Hughesian version of our world, we'll say. And is that about that? I guess I am going to make you answer it.
No, you totally hit the nail on the head. I mean, you know, I fucking love genre. I'm never going to stop doing like fantasy and sci-fi and all sorts of crazy weirdness. But, you know, when you do those genres, you know, you do have to devote a lot of, you know, narrative real estate to it. You need to explain the world. You need to explore your various sci-fi concepts. You know, you are usually on some sort of heightened plot that, you know, you're saving the world or stopping a big villain. And, you know, and again, I absolutely love those stories all day, every day. But those are all aspects that took away from what I was kind of do, which was really just really kind of hone in and kind of laser focus on L and what they were feeling and what they were experiencing. And I thought for something that just kind of focuses a lot more on this character's internal life and especially dealing with this issue of, you know, coming out as non-binary, exploring their gender, becoming more confident in it. I kind of felt that any additional genre trappings might be, you know, a little distracting or take away from just the focus on Elle's coming of age themes.
I love that. That's like a lot to think about with the idea of like, I love the way you put it of like, it wasn't about, not, obviously it's about, it's still about nerddom, right? It's still widely a book about all the things that I think the three of us would probably be like, hell yeah. I mean, we already have for like an hour. What am I saying? So, you know, that's so important, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. It's a little similar to Renegade Rule in that I hope, you know, with Renegade Rule, I kind of hoped, you know, with all the girls and their different ways of playing and they're approaching video games, the reader would be like, oh, one of these characters is like how I play a game, or, ooh, this character is just like how my friend plays a game when we play together. I definitely hope people, you know, especially, you know, queer nerds see themselves in LK Humble and, you know, taking way too personal when people criticize media that was a big part of your personal journey.
That's real.
First thing in the morning, go like, you know, when your mind is still like 2/3 asleep and you do the most useless thing you could ever do, which is just check up if there's an update on an internet argument. but yeah, and no, it really is just, and again, in that sense of, you know, if a lot of what I want to do with that character of Lila Griffin and non-binary rep was, you know, take this genre work, you know, sci-fi action that I'm very familiar with and add a very non-binary aspect to it and have a human non-binary character. This is very much kind of, you know, the next level of like, not only is non-binary human, but we don't just exist when the world is at stake or when there's magic involved or aliens involved. We are human and we exist going to school, planning stuff to do with our friends over the weekend.
And our non-binariness influences those things, right? The how, the what. You know, it's so important that Elle is in this point where they have, it's pretty recent that they've realized they're non-binary. They have words for something they felt for a very long time. They are still, you know, nervous about wearing the dress they love. They're still nervous about what bullies are saying about them. And what they find is, you know, they start out the book very, very alone, despite having two awesome friends who are so much fun to read. I mean, Taylor as Himbo, 10 out of 10. Agatha as like witch with possibly dark arts powers, 10 out of 10. I'm obsessed.
Where I really felt like I had a real handle on Taylor and Agatha was when I realized that both of them were becoming absolute chaos gremlins, but from opposite ends of the spectrum.
So funny and cute and sweet and real, you know, just like perfect that way. But, you know, Elle starts out in this place of, you know, they are the non-binary person they know, besides a fictional character played by a non-binary actor. But what they find, and this is one of the things I just adore about this book, is that queerness is infused in their world in lots of small ways. There's a teacher who mentions her girlfriend. There's another kid at a laser tag game who has a bi pin on. I'm not going to spoil how great that scene is, but it is. There's another kid at the signing who's exploring their gender in a way that Elle was just confounded. Like, you're not confounded in like, I don't get it, but like shocked at this person because Elle was so certain they knew who that person was. You know, that was just, it's also beautiful, but it also makes it clear this isn't just about Elle. It's a part of the world and it's a part of Elle's world. It's a part of our world. And I'm curious, you know, what do you think those moments bring to the book? I mean, I've told you what they mean to me, but I'm curious as an author, you know, what it is, what you were trying to do with those things. And, you know, do you think you succeeded? Do you think the book holds those moments in a way that feels good to you?
Yeah. I mean, I think whether the book succeeds, I think that's something that will always be up to the reader. But it was definitely something where, like you said, like, it's not like, for me, my queerness, it's not just something that only exists to me. Like, it does. Like, it makes you so much more aware of what's going on in the world. I mean, hell, you know, when you feel alone and even the hint of somebody else being queer can feel like a life raft that you're not alone. So I was trying to express that and, you know, and kind of put readers a little bit in Elle's mindset of, like, they do see safety and acceptance in a queer community and they are on the lookout for it to try to find it when they can. You know, like you said, with, like, all they have is this fictional character played by a non-binary person, but someone who's a celebrity is, you know, try to show. I really wanted to, you know, show how important and beneficial fictional representation can be, but then also show that it's not a cure-all, that there's a limit, that especially when you don't have community. And I think, you know, a lot of what's tied into Ella's kind of coming of age is, you know, the various other queer people they run into along this adventure of a day and starting to feel, and I think a lot of, you know, feeling stronger about themselves the more they realize that they're a part of a community, realizing, you know, the people that helped them and gave them comfort and that they're going to be a link in the chain and help others find them themselves was certainly what I hope came across. I mean, even in that meta sense of this is a book about a non-binary kid wishing they had more non-binary characters around to help them. And hopefully Elle themselves will be in themselves a non-binary character that helps non-binary kids.
I hope so. You know, it's been very, there was something you said earlier. Oh no, it was the way Sarah said it. Sarah said, you know, it's like, oh, creating a different timeline in which we got to find ourselves in maybe less traumatic ways is my takeaway from what Sarah said. And, you know, I think sometimes as a queer person, as a trans person, what I like about reading queer and trans YA is that it kind of heals the part of me that didn't get to be that person, that had to pass, that had to fit in, that was too, you know, caught up in the trauma of my own life to even fight for myself. And I see Elle and it's such a beautiful, simple feeling. I told you before we started recording, I got to the last third of the book and, you know, I just was bawling my little eyes out, just so moved to see a whole community of people, including lots of people Elle didn't expect, you know, showing up for them in ways that felt respectful and fascinating, actually. Really, like, the world was so much richer. And I don't know, I think a part of me, I think the seventh grade non-binary kid in me might have healed a little bit in reading that. So I do hope it reaches lots of non-binary kids. And I hope it reaches all kinds of kids who can learn to love their non-binary friends more. But I also hope a lot of adults will read it too.
I hope so. Like, I hope my biggest hope is that this is just a book that, like, it's a good read. At the end of the day, like, that it's a good story that makes people feel feelings and think thoughts. but no, I really hope it. I hope it helps some non-binary people. I hope it offers, maybe it offers a way of being, or it, you know, it offers that kind of. It introduces the possibility the way that I was so helped when the possibility of being non-binary first came into my life, and it felt like, you know, like someone had pulled off a curtain. I was like, oh, that's a whole way of being. I can do that. So I hope it can help people with their journey. And I hope people that aren't non-binary, I hope people can read this, enjoy it, and come across with a much deeper understanding of what it's like being non-binary and being understanding of and supportive of that experience and the non-binary people in their life. I mean, look, it is a scary time. There is so much bad going on, but if there's hope, I see it from young people who are standing up, saying who they are, and fighting for it in a way that, man, I wish I could have done that when I was their age.
I mean, fighting for each other, right? Like, there's this moment where Elle is misgendered and Elle's like, whoa, that's not right. I am going to stand up for myself. This is who I am. And the person is like, that's stupid. That's not real. A singular they, please. And Agatha, like, just stands up and is like, oh, just so you know, the singular they has been used since blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's just this moment.
Oh, Agatha,
like,
went fucking Oxford Dictionary.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she did. And, like, that's a beautiful example of allyship. And, you know, allyship in some ways feels like a label that's, I don't know, maybe for other people, but it does feel like this really important moment where the friendship is so powerful and so real that Agatha couldn't let someone misgender L. And I'll be honest, like I to this day don't experience that, like very rarely. And I think it's an amazing example of the ways that people can love each other better.
Yeah, I mean, hell, part of it, I joke around that, like, that's another part of the fantasy. What if I'd had friends in seventh grade?
Your ice cold. Take that, little Ben.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I mean, look, when I came out, there was, you know, I had such loving and supportive friends who were always, who always had my back. And, you know, they, even when they don't get it, they didn't, you know, they don't fully understand the non-binary experience. And there is that isolation of feeling alone with that identity. Still just knowing that having friends who love you and who got your back, you know, it can mean the absolute world. I mean, there's, to be weird to like quote, the Justice League movie, to think I think actually quote the like the theatrical cut of the Justice League movie, Bratman has a line that's always stuck with me where he says, I don't have to understand this world, I just have to save it. And I think that's what, you know, Agatha and Taylor will always bring. It's like, they may not understand what Elle's going through, but they're always going to be there to fight for them.
Well, and I think that's actually a really important flashpoint for people. I think this is the thing that I wish I could get more people who aren't non-binary on board with, who aren't trans on board with. You don't have to understand. No one cares if you get it. No one cares if you get it. I don't need you to get it. I don't. But I do need you to not want to kill me.
Yes.
I do need you to believe I have a right to be alive and to choose my happiness, even if the way I choose my happiness and manifest it isn't what you would choose.
Yeah, like I shouldn't have to choose between wearing skirts and having human rights. That seems like
I want a shirt that says that.
That seems like a dumb, very dumb that those two would even be correlated.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Yeah, this. Oh man, you know, it's like sometimes writing the book, it's just being like, yeah, now this guy's gonna talk with a Hulk Hogan voice, and it's only when you look at it afterwards you're like, oh fuck, I think I might have put a lot of realness of myself into this. In between the Hulk Hogan voices, of course.
You're like, well, maybe that's also me. Who can say?
Look, I had a lot of fun. One of my favorite parts of the editing process was one day during the proofreading phase, and I just get an email from my editor being like, proofreader found the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia reference. And then about 30 minutes later, I get another email going like, all right, now she found the What We Do in the Shadows reference.
I mean, I caught your dodgeball reference. There were a couple others that I was like, oh, this is good. Oh, Ben's putting it all in here. I love it.
Oh, all those references, by the way, none of those references got cut. All those references did make it into the final book.
I think I did catch the What We Do in the Shadows one too, because I was like, is this the What We Do in the Shadows? And now you said it, I'm like,
I needed like a fancy sounding name for an artist, so I just like smushed as many What We Do in the Shadows character names as I could reasonably fit together.
That's so funny. Oh my God.
But yeah, no, I think with this, it's like, this is my attitude, you know, whether it's comics, whether it's novels, I'm a big believer that if you have fun creating a story, that fun is going to carry through and the readers are going to have fun with you. Mm. So, you know, to me, it's like when I realize like, ooh, there's going to be a really steep hill in town and I need to name that hill. I think it took maybe all of half a second before my brain went, it's Hank's Hill, like the cartoon.
Perfect. Yeah. You know, I think we have to do a whole different episode that is Ben Kahn's writing tips, how to name shit.
All right. Another writing tip. Throw in a Shrek reference. Everyone loves Shrek. All right. I will give you my actual serious, an actual serious writing tip.
Do it.
This is specifically if you're writing like, you know, like fantasy or sci-fi or like anything involving like powers. If you are struggling to come up with like a good kind of power set or design for like a character, just pick a Pokemon and make like a human version of that Pokemon. There's a thousand of the fuckers. Just make a Pokemon. Just whatever powers that Pokemon has, just give it to that character. It's a frog that's got, it's like a poison dart frog that's fighting people. Great. Now your character is like a monk with like poison fists. You're welcome.
You're woke. Solved all your problems.
Don't break your brain trying to figure out like new interesting power sets or designs. Again, just borrow one from Pokemon. There's so many of them.
I actually love that. I love that. Okay, this is, I don't have a good segue. I've been trying to get the good segue, but it's...
We can make the hard pivot. I'm into it.
And it kind of comes back to, you know, how we started our conversation, except not the Riverdale part. Nothing could ever come back to Riverdale. Just kidding. Everything comes back to Riverdale. But, you know, something that I really loved that's a thread throughout the book is this way that comic books are this kind of tension point. The substitute teacher is like very upset that a comic book would be in his classroom. And we know this is actually really true to real life. There's still people who talk about, you know, you can't read comic books. That doesn't count as reading. A graphic novel isn't a book. It doesn't count towards our reading competition, which, you know, we can talk about that a whole different day. But the thing is, those of us who work with kids, who work in comics, we know that comics are really helpful for literacy, especially with reluctant readers. And in my perspective, neurodivergent folks, it can get people reading. Plus, comics are fucking cool.
Oh, yeah. Like, comics are great.
Comics are so cool. So I wanted to know why you wanted to deal with that tension in the story and what it means to you.
Some of it is just, you know, even in a novel, I still got to have comic books in there. Can't let go of my roots.
You still are who you are,
exactly.
You know?
And part so much is what it is, just what you said, you know, this medium that I love so dearly that is so beneficial. There's so many uses. It's so good for reading. So good for just telling wonderful stories. Like how we were saying, like you can tell stories in comics and novel tie-ins that you probably can't get away with in like your actual like movie or television show. But yeah, part of it was just kind of, you know, to be a cheerleader, to kind of speak out against, you know, the disrespect the medium gets and kind of show how bullish and unfair that is. Part of it was just, you know, putting a little more of myself in L of being like, well, I fucking love comics, so L should love comics. But yeah, it was like, and again, like, I really like, because I always think like back to like, oh, well, one thing stuck with me as a kid was like, oh, if only you could study as much as like you care about this, like this show or something like that. And again, like, and to me, like, I can never understand, like, why is this thing bad? Like, it's engaging my mind. It's doing all these things you say a mind should be doing. Why is it bad? Because like it's not in a textbook. And I kind of just wanted to have, you know, just show like when it comes to Phantom Thief, especially a show like L has probably learned more from it about history from being a Phantom Thief super fan than they have sitting in really bad history classes. And, you know, and show like, hey, this is a kid who edutainment works better if they can connect it to stuff.
Why is this reminding me of how I used to have to like use the dictionary whenever I was reading X-Men comics? Because some of the stuff that they say is very weird.
I mean, I'm so glad you bring up X-Men dialogue in particular, because I mean, I kind of gave that a little Easter egg when I named the bookstore the Purple Prose Bookshop.
Right. The Claremont Bookshop, yeah. Is basically it. Here we are in the city of Claremont and it's the Purple basically.
But yeah, I'd say a lot of it was just, you know, because I think back to myself, like, hey, I remember being a kid and loving Donkey Kong Country. And then one of the earliest books I read was like, ooh, they made a like a Donkey Kong Country like kids novel. And I ate that shit up. So part of it was just being
right.
Yeah. So part of it was just kind of showing that kind of the way, you know, love for one medium can really stretch to learning in others. And also, again, just try to get that backdoor pilot in for that Phantom Thief graphic novel series. Got to build up that buzz. Get the Phantom Man going.
I want to read it, honestly. Well, it's so funny because I have like a question, but literally it's just Ferris Bueller non-binary icon? Question mark.
I also thought about Ferris Bueller. I love this.
Well, because, like, isn't Ferris Bueller kind of a non-binary icon?
I'm like, just flashing back through every outfit he wears in that movie and going, like, God,
yeah,
there is a version
it, right?
of this movie where Ferris Bueller is a masked lesbian, and it's incredible.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I love this. I was like, there is something a little trans about Ferris Bueller, and I don't know what I think
he's a quasi-magical androgynous trickster, and that's Loki as
right.
fuck. And we all know Loki is the most non-binary of the gods.
Yes.
Yeah, that was one thing. When I was like going through like Ferris Bueller taking notes on like to get like lessons and figure out kind of what I wanted to adapt or what there was to be learned from Ferris Bueller. One thing I had in my notes was like, no quasi-magical sociopaths.
But didn't you kind of, I mean, we're not going to call her a sociopath, but didn't you kind of break the rule with Agatha?
Okay, no quasi-magical sociopaths for the main character. Supporting characters, yeah, there's going to be some quasi-magical sociopaths. I mean, Agatha is my thank you note to every super morbid, like, serial killer-obsessed goth girl I befriended in middle school who probably realized that shit was not right with me before I did. Gender-wise, I mean. Not all the other stuff that's wrong with me. But yeah, I had so much fun writing Agatha. I mean, it's probably writing where it's like, you know, Elle really got to be the most fleshed out three-dimensional character. You know, we're very much in their internal headspace. And as a result, you know, we're really in their POV and less so in their friend's POV. So, but man, was it just a lot of fun just watching them be just fucking just mischievous kids who like getting into trouble and have a lot of fun hanging out and, you know, doing goofy shit that they're going to be telling stories about for years.
What do you think is a good lesson to take from Ferris Bueller? Because we were talking, you know, I mean, I don't think that I'm, I guess, out of line to say that, like, there is some kind of John Hughes influence.
I would say practical lesson to be learned that if you are going to joyride a car, you cannot just run it in reverse and make the mileage go down. That is a practical life lesson.
Oh my God. Yeah, I feel like that the rant that Cameron goes on where he's like, what do you love? You love a car. You love a car. Like, what do you love? Who do you love? And like, that goes through my head literally almost every day just because we live in such a capitalist society that it's just like, it's this moment that you wouldn't necessarily think would just forever stay with you and just be like always there. And I'm just like, honestly, it is though.
I know. I do think there is a positive lesson to be taken from Ferris Bueller. And I think it's one that I may have made a little more, I guess, not sure if explicit is the right word, but more like, I guess, at the forefront with it being escaping detention instead of skipping a normal day of school. But I think the positive lesson to be taken from Ferris Bueller's is you shouldn't let the demands and burdens of society keep you from taking the time to celebrate joy with your loved ones. Because that really is what Ferris Bueller is about, is it's about him deciding he doesn't want to spend a day being unhappy. He wants to spend a day celebrating joy with his two favorite people in the world.
And his sister is like, fuck that.
And yeah. His sister's just a fuck. Like, look, you can be both morally correct and a hater. You're allowed to be both. Yeah.
His sister is probably the funniest character.
Oh my God. Her scene with Charlie Sheen in the police station.
So funny.
Will have me dying every time I watch it.
You care a lot about what your brother does, but why don't you turn that vision in on yourself or whatever he says? And she's just like, what? Shut the fuck up.
Charlie Sheen as the sexy, wise, bad boy delinquent. Just, oh.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Amazing movie.
Chef's kiss on that. And I gotta say, like, honestly, Ferris Bueller might be the best among the kind of 80s comedies just because there's not, to me, a lot of, like, Pretty in Pink, you know, like, there's a lot of other movies of that era that are really uncomfortable to watch because you're just, like, so sexist, so, like, homophobic, so racist, and then Ferris Bueller is just, like, wholesome.
Ferris Bueller,
for the most part,
might very well be a sociopath, but what he is not is bigoted nor a sex criminal, which is not something you can say for everyone in that movie. Looking at you, Principal Rooney.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no kidding. You're just like, settle down, Rooney.
Yeah. Well, also that actor in real life, unfortunately, too. That was one thing, again, watching it being like, okay, this slapstick isn't real. Slapstick vice principal gets hurt isn't going to really work in pro. So I think we can cross that subplot off the things to. But no, I mean, honestly, John Hughes and especially Ferris Bueller was a very big influence. You know, I called this Broderick Middle School. But I think what was also probably, you know, because I was a 90s kid. I came to the John Hughes, you know, 80s stuff a little later. I think what really, and I don't think I was conscious of this influence while I was writing it, but I think what a lot of what influenced my sense of kind of absurdism or eccentricity within the suburb setting, or like a little bit of like a heightened feel to that suburb, I think it was a lot of Pete and Pete influence. If you remember Pete and Pete from that 90s show on yes. Nickelodeon.
Sure do. Yes, I do. Cracking up because this is like maybe the first time Pete and Pete has been referenced on this show, but that seems odd.
It should be more celebrated and iconic, Pete and Pete, but I think that was definitely like kind of in the back of my head where I'm like, okay, with every location they go to, it's like, what absolute fucking weirdo are they going to run into at the next place they go? Like what layer of absurdity is going to be right below this normal like veneer? So yeah, I think it was a lot of John Hughes and a lot of celebrating queer representation and trying to, you know, kind of express that journey of exploration and little Pete and Pete is the secret ingredient. But no, I mean, you mentioned that it takes place after they come out, after Ella's come out. And that was very intentional on my part, just because, you know, look, it's great that there's so many wonderful coming out stories. It's a very important story to tell. I'm really glad there's so many people telling it. But just for me personally as a creator, it's not the part of queer life that I found myself most interested in exploring. Like, it took me like 2 weeks to figure out and come out that I was non-binary once I learned what non-binary was. It has taken several years to explore what that all means and how to express it and stand up for that. Like, so that's been a much bigger chapter in my life. So I wanted to express that journey, that part of the gender journey in the book.
I love that. I like coming out stories, you know, I think you're right that a lot of queer and trans media is dedicated to them. And that's sort of a...
I am in no way bad-mouthing coming out stories. They are very
important. No, it's just, no.
For me, personally, as a creator, the story that most excited me to tell was something else in the journey.
Well, what I was starting to say is, you know, it's like to some degree, which is, you know, we can put a big asterisk by this. We can have an episode where we talk about the philosophy of coming out. I myself am very ambivalent about the whole thing. But listen, you know, it is a more finite experience than the experience of being queer all the time, being non-binary all the time, being trans all the time. There's so much to figure out and navigate in that experience that coming out is a sliver of. And so it's cool to see a book, especially one for kids so young, that is on the process. It's about, the, you know, the process that continues. How does it keep unfurling from there?
Yeah, and I was like, I didn't want to have to spend the whole book just building up to getting the reader used to using they, them pronouns at the end. Like, I kind of wanted to just hit the ground running. I mean, one thing that was, when we were coming up with titles, one thing that I kind of didn't want to budge on that like was kind of very much there always in every version of every proposed version of the title was I really wanted to have the they them pronoun right there in the title. Mm-hmm. Just make it so you cannot look away from this character's non-binary identity. It is literally right there in the title on the cover.
Did you get pushback on that?
Not even a little. No.
That's good.
No. I mean, look, we came through some options. I mean, look, titles are really fucking hard. I mean, we had some different options, but it was always just like, oh, do you think that rolls off the tongue better? Ooh, I think this flows a little nicer. But no, the idea that like we want to, that like non-binary identity would be front and center. Like, no, I never received anything but the most enthusiastic and wholehearted of support from Scholastic.
Mm. I was actually just looking at the cover too, and it's just so fun. It's so expressive.
Oh, I mean, that it's Mui. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right. Mouis Katir, Mouis, M-U-I-S, is the cover artist. Again, that we were able to get a non-binary artist to do the cover. And, you know, you talk about what's different, but, you know, coming from comics to prose, one thing that was tough about prose was, ooh, I don't get to see like art. I don't like actually get to see these characters. I don't get to see them like interacting, because when you're writing comics, you know, you write the script, but it doesn't really, it's not really real until like there's art for it. So it was kind of like, even though I'd written this entire novel, my comics brain was still so trained that it was really only once that cover, only really once I saw the cover and I could see the characters and their designs, did I go like, oh, this is real now. I wrote a book. These characters exist.
Oh, what a surreal experience.
Just a wonderful cover. So big shout out to Moise for just designing that amazing thing. And I mean, they put in so many details. I mean, that L that is wearing like, a star constellation leggings, I think gets mentioned in one sentence in the book, and they got it right on the cover. I mean, just one absolutely wonderful, just seeing those characters just spring off the page.
It is so beautiful. What a wonderful book. Sarah, did you have any more questions about L. Campbell's Windsor Weekend?
There's going to be a follow-up, right? Was that just announced? Am I correct? Did I lie?
To the novel, I do have ideas for where it could take off, more L. Campbell or some story ideas that might put Taylor and Agatha in the driver's seat for more fun stuff, but nothing official yet.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought that there had been announced a sequel. So that
Sarah just wants it so bad.
Me willing that into reality. So.
I mean, I can tell you, I very much have ideas for where the sequel would go and what it would build on from this first one.
I see. Yes, good. Well, Scholastic, if you're listening. But I guess now my question will be the one that I tend to end on, which is basically, what is coming next? Are you going to, I mean, the sequel now is out there in my mind, at least. But yeah, what are you working on? Because I mean, a book, I guess like probably just like the promotion of the book is probably a good thing to focus on. But
it is absolutely amazing this book is out. Also, Captain Laserhawk, a Blood Dragon remix. Go watch it on Netflix and then get ready because I wrote the manga, official manga for the show that's coming out this winter from Tokyo Pop. I worked on it with show creator Adi Shakur. Bayou Kun is the artist. That's BayouKun. It's absolutely, not only am I not, do I get to say I'm a novelist this year, I get to say I'm a manga writer. Holy shit, is 2000s been losing their mind over that. So that is going to be really fun. And then you can catch me every Friday co-hosting podcast Progressively Horrified, holding horror movies and shows to progressive standards that they never asked to. Me, Jeremy, comics creators Jeremy Whitley and Emily Martin get together every week with a whole bunch of great guests to dissect and dive into the wonderful world of horror movies.
Mm-hmm. And we are, yes, this is a good podcast.
Yes, and we are absolutely going to have Sarah and Essie. We are going to get you on episodes soon.
Well, as you know, I am a big horror fan.
That's my horror laugh. Oh my gosh, Ben. Well, you know what I always think when I think about you is, wow, they don't do much. You know, I wish they'd really get to work. No, that's a joke. You obviously are always out there working your ass off. One of the things I love is that you both are working on new things and constantly reminding people of projects that are in, you know, exist in a digital format and are coming to print, all those pieces. And I think that's a really hard aspect of being a creative is managing that promotion and keeping things in front of people because like when you're talking about the title, there's just so many goddamn books, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And so you have to really continue to remind people. Is there anything that you've done to like help yourself? I'm just thinking about like some of our listeners are creatives and they're working on projects and I get to hear about them sometimes, which is really cool. But I'm curious for you, you know, are there any tips you have for creatives in managing all this, the other piece, right? Like not the writing, not the, you know, the creativity, even though you gave us some good writing advice, go check out Pokemon people if you get stuck. but like, you know, how do you do the other parts of it? How do you make time for it?
So it's definitely not easy. I mean, part of it's also just like, you know, when it comes to promoting the old books, it's that, I mean, hell, you pour so much of yourself into every one of these books. I mean, anyone can be years of your life. It's even when it's done, it's hard to let that love go. So it's always kind of a joy getting to revisit those old writing experiences. I mean, like, if you're on social media, if you're doing Instagram and TikTok, you know, if you're on comic, if you have like an old comic and stuff, like old comics you want to get more attention to. I mean, I always just try to, you know, post little panels or snippets of older works. I mean, there's no reason that you can't keep presenting that content to people in new ways, you know, reels showing different pages. I mean, even if to you it's something you made years ago, when you post about it, it could be somebody's very first time even knowing it exists. So, you know, it's very easy to just feel like, you know, almost like have to keep moving forward. And that's very important. But, you know, the works we've done in the past, they still mean a lot to us, and they're still a part of who we are and what we've created. And I think sometimes it's just a matter of, shining the spotlight back on them. You know, if you're doing a newsletter, you know, in addition to all the cool new stuff you got coming out, maybe you have like a little blast from the past section to let people who know, you know, if someone became a fan with your third book, let them know what you were doing in your second book before they hopped on board.
Listen, I did not ask that so that you would give me personally tips, but I am going to use all of them. That was amazing. I really love that idea. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah, it's like, it's still, especially now as a writer on Instagram, where it's very much not a writer's medium. I mean, if you're looking for kind of stuff to post, I mean, snippets of old work, you know, particular jokes, really great panels, images, like, I'm not going to say it's content because fuck that. It's art and storytelling, but it's, you know, just because it's a few years old doesn't mean everyone's seen it or it's no good to post anymore. It's like, I think, you know, it's a way to introduce it to new people and people that, and if it is a few years old, like, there's a good chance that people that did read it back when it first came out will enjoy the reminder of it. So, you know, that's a story stick with you. And I mean that both emotionally and in your social media feeds.
Oh my gosh, Ben, we've been everywhere. We went to Riverdale. We went to...
I was just going to say, we've pretty much stayed in Riverdale.
We went to Riverdale.
And we refused to leave.
We went to the south side of Riverdale, where the serpents live.
Where's Cheryl? If I don't meet Cheryl Blossom, I will die. I will just die. I came to Riverdale for a reason, and it's to join an anarchist lesbian
cult.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh my gosh. Well, Ben, if folks want to learn more about you, and obviously L. Campbell wins their weekend, where can they learn more?
Definitely visit my website, benconcomics.com. Sign up for my newsletter. I am still occasionally posting on Twitter at BenTheCon, but you can find me at Blue Sky at BenConWrites, Instagram at BenConComics, and yeah, catch me every Friday on Progressively Horrified.
That was like a lot of things. So it's like, but how are they going to find you?
I know. I got to consolidate the names. I'm sorry about that. That was a big old mouthful.
Listen, we've all been there.
But that's cool. We have show notes.
I started the Instagram. Exactly. I'm like, well, I only make comics. I'll be BenCon Comics. And now Blue Sky's out. I'm like, well, shit, I don't just make comics anymore, do I? Okay, well, now it's BenCon Writes. You know what? I got to change the Instagram to BenCon Writes. That's the solution.
Well, listeners, don't you worry your pretty little heads if you didn't have a pencil and or got lost about which one was the BenCon Comics or BenCon Writes, because you can click the three dots next to the title or description of this episode. I think it depends on what platform you're using, but it doesn't matter. When you click it, it'll expand. And down there in the show notes, I will link to everything Ben just mentioned. And, you know, maybe I'll link to some other surprises as well. Make sure, listeners, to check out L. Campbell Wins Their Weekend. Pick it up in print, because that's what it is. Or you can pick it up at your library if you'd like as well. Get out there, support the book. If you know any middle graders, that's not a term that means anything outside of publishing. If you know any middle schoolers, please make sure you get this book in their hands. It's good shit. Ben, it is always a pleasure to have you here. I like Sarah said, you're one of our most recurring guests. That's the technical term. Guests, and we are extremely happy to have you be one of them because you fucking rule.
Thank you so much. I have so much fun every time I get to come on and talk with you both. This is absolutely wonderful. Seriously, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my heart is full. I'm ready for a good day. Sarah, you know I love you. I won't say any more compliments, except you're funny. You're cool. I just want to be like you when I grow up. Monica, I love you. I miss your face. I miss your voice. I know you're working hard. Get back to studying, you fool. And Kate, thank you for always making us sound great. You are the absolute best.
You got to say something about Kyoko.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And pretty baby Kyoko, pretty baby kitty who never let me see you in person because you don't like anyone but your mom. I love you.
Your mom whose neck you live upon.
We love you, Kyoko.
We love Kyoko. We love you, listeners. Patrons, thank you for keeping us afloat. You have made this dream a reality. I love you all. Take care of yourselves. Hug someone if you like hugs. If you don't like hugs, wave at them from across the room. Have a great day, y'all.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.
Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @bitchesoncomics and on Instagram at @bitchesoncomics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.